Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's a fine day in March 2018. My question is today a very exciting one. What is the significance of breath? I'm tempted to say breath is no more significant than anything else, and no more insignificant than anything else. But yoga people, spiritual wallahs in general, make a big thing of it. In the most well-known yoga texts, the Yoga Sutra and Hatha Yoga Pradipika, there is quite some significance given over to pranayama. Pranayama is often understood as breathing exercises, even though prana is a wider concept than breath. It's a concept of universal energy, life force energy, vitality, and it's actually an ancient concept that's found across the ancient world. Find it in Taoism. The Sufis and the Vajrayanaists all talk about it. It's known in the West, the Greeks had things to say about it. And there is a general philosophy, you might say, which we call vitalism, which says that there is some sort of animating energy that operates in living things. So pranayama strictly means energy discipline. At this point, we should take a little look at what Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra says about pranayama, and what Svatmarama says about it in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. Or we could go wider on texts. We could go outside of the Sanskrit traditions even if we wanted to, and take a huge survey. But for a brief podcast, I'm going to just stick to these two sort of rather prominent texts. Patanjali doesn't have actually a lot to say about anything. Patanjali actually is very aphoristic when he's discussing pranayama. Pranayama, I think, is the fourth limb of the eight limbs. It's dealt with in the second chapter of the Yoga Sutra, Sadhanapada. And Patanjali says about it that practice, it's the Sadhanapada, it's the chapter on practice. And he talks about practice of breathing in, holding the breath, breathing out. And he doesn't say much more about it than that. It's not very elaborate. There's no discussion of ratios and bandhas and locks and kundalini energy or any of these things. It's just a kind of a hint that something can be done, breathing in deeply, holding the breath, breathing in. And after that, which Patanjali deals with in just a few words really, he adds the idea that there's a fourth method, was breathing in, holding, breathing out, of the methods, that there's a fourth consideration, and doesn't say that much about it. And it strikes me that what he's talking about there is a discipline of allowing, a discipline of letting the breath just be very relaxed, very soft. And it's not controlled, but it's not inhibited either by any sort of pathology, any grasping for the in-breath, or any holding on fearfully to the out-breath, in case it's the last one you ever do. And it's fairly mysterious. I was taught that the fourth was a Rajayoga Pranayama, and was just a very easeful breath that was allowed to settle. And of course, if one does settle there, sitting posture or in a cupped posture, the breath can actually really slow right down and become very, very subtle and fine and kind of delicious. So that's what Patanjali has to say about it. And he's, I suppose what he's saying is that there is an opportunity with breath to catch a glimpse of the being state of yoga, which if you go back over these podcasts, you'll find these mentioned all the time. Hatha Yoga Pradipika is a bit more involved. He understands Hatha Yoga breathing exercises, which are kind of quite forceful and quite controlling, through a picture of the human organism as being composed of elements and energies and so forth, more or less along the lines of Samkhya, and very much in the vitalist school. I would say about that, about having a picture of how the human being works, that Patanjali is kind of agnostic. Don't tell us too much. He just says, this gives rise to this, this gives rise to this. This is how this is, this is how this is. In a very, very simple fashion, without appealing very much to a model of how human beings are. Now, the kerfuffle in the modern times about breath, about pranayama, and so forth, seems to me to be sort of quite highly dependent on these elaborate pictures or models of how the human being works, with notions of energies like Kundalini and so forth, and nadis, energy channels within the body, elements, chakras, that whole kind of map or picture of the microcosm. I think we need at this point to ask ourselves, well, what is the nature of those kinds of explanations? Well, they do kind of fit, even though they sort of have obviously been elaborated. You know, they, by fit, I mean, they do have a certain explanatory force. And that they are a kind of a hermeneutic of lived experience of people who meditate a lot and get into some, what you might call, non-ordinary states of awareness. But I think after that there's definitely been a whole kind of layer of elaboration and imagination. And without much basis other than imagination. And this is why, for instance, the Taoists, the Sufis, the Vajrayanaists, and the various Sanskritic traditions can tell us stories about chakras and energy vortexes and channels and all the rest of it. But there is difference in detail. And there's also a difference in which part of this story is the most significant. And this varies from tradition to tradition. And even varies locally within the big traditions. Which to me indicates that yes, there is elaboration going on. There is an imposition onto the human organism of a cultural understanding. But nevertheless, that imposition isn't on the basis of nothing. It is on the basis of some observable phenomena. Now, the matter gets complicated because everybody who buys into one of these stories thinks that it's the reality. They don't see that it's an elaboration of imagination, admittedly on the basis of something fairly readily observable to most human beings. We are told when we encounter these stories and the dissemination of these stories that they are absolutely true, true with a capital T. And I think nothing could be further from the truth, ordinary T, than that. And a little investigation, a little reflection does indicate that we are dealing with cultural impositions and with stories. Now, in a matter of breath, we can observe that our moods, feelings, states of being are breath dependent, or breath correlated more accurately, we should say. You know, if we were suddenly frightened, somebody jumps out of the hedge with a knife, looks like they're going to stick it in you, your heart suddenly starts beating fast, and your breathing speeds up, becomes fitful. If you're anxious, you breathe kind of shallowly. And emotional reactions like sobbing and laughing with joy are all functions of the breath. They all obviously involve a breath pattern correlated with the emotion. We all know that. And the yoga move at this point is to reverse engineer. Is to say, if when I'm frightened I breathe like this, and if when I'm calm I breathe like this, and if when I'm very peaceful I breathe like this, maybe I can recreate peace when I'm not very peaceful by copying the breath pattern of peace and imposing it on myself. And then I can kind of engineer my moods that way. So there becomes this like reverse engineering approach based on an observation that anybody can observe, and that's a truism of human life. Breath and mood are correlated. Breath and feeling are correlated. Breath and emotional state are correlated. Doesn't actually necessarily work that way, to be honest. You know the story of the chap who was revered as a great sage in India, and he did seem to have some kind of wisdom, and was always joyful and loving. People said that this chap was enlightened. But what had happened to this guy is that he'd got the habit, like many Indians, of riding on the top of the train. Free or cheap. but one day he kind of miscalculated when the train went under a bridge and got a severe bang on the head. And when he came round in the hospital, he was in this kind of beatific state, blessed state, permanent joy and full of loving feeling. And then after, loads of people were kind of throwing themselves against walls and off cliffs and actually sitting on trains and letting themselves get a bang on the head. Pretty well all to no avail. Most of them, of course, died. And there is a big presupposition in reverse engineering, and this is what that story points out, that you can reverse engineering that way. I actually think it's very limited. Mainly because there's an extra ingredient when you reverse engineer. If your breath's very soft and very delicious, and because you're in a blissful state and very, 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 very sort of deep but slow, maybe almost imperceptible, you think, okay, I'll recreate that breath because I'm not feeling very blissful, and that will take me into the blissful place. You, of course, are putting an extra agent in the equation. In other words, that which is directing the show, the willpower that's imposing the breathing pattern. And alongside that, all the notions of practice and asceticism and keeping to the discipline and so on. This is another causative agent within the pattern that's not present when bliss spontaneously arises. And I think this can be demonstrated through practice. You know, it is probably worth practicing some of this stuff, some of the Hatha Yoga, Pranayama, maybe following the discipline of pranayama, 80 rounds at midnight, 80 rounds at dawn, 80 rounds at midday, 80 rounds at sunset for 6 months or something. Pretty arduous, pretty rigorous. So you can find out what it involves, and it does do things. I mean, it disrupts the system. Similarly, hyperventilation and various yoga cults kind of really love hyperventilation. But what are they doing? Of course, you get kind of dizzy and a bit high. or even a lot high. But actually, all you've done is manipulate the system. You haven't settled into the ordinary and found the blessings that are in there. You've just manipulated your system. And I kind of think drugs are more effective, to be honest with you. But it's worth doing it to see what it is, so that you know what it is. And of course, you know, the various yoga cults that kind of snare people with these effects, with these sometimes spectacular effects, are doing the thing of telling you that these sensations, this dizziness, this hyperventilation, this buzzing in your body is significant in such and such a way. It's the divine presence or whatever. But without that endowment of the significance, without that interpretation, the effects are just effects. And you have to be very careful on this territory, because what you're dealing with is psyops and cult generation for purposes of exploitation. So be careful, I would say. At the same time, it is worth putting a bit of time over, perhaps to that Hatha yoga program, if that floats your boat. But in solitude, as prescribed in the text, and find out. And then put it aside, which I think you'll want to. I mean, it's almost as though some of the severe disciplines exist so that one can discover the limits of asceticism. I mean, the limit of asceticism is that the mad mind cannot cure the mad mind. And the effort can't overthrow effort. Effort can never not be noise. Silence can't be instantiated by making an enormous clatter. So I'm not saying don't do it, but I am saying be aware, test it. Everything should be tested in this field. Everything. And I said right at the beginning of this that, well, breath is no more significant than anything else, but no more insignificant than anything else. Because basically this is it. And that means every little scintilla of consciousness that you experience between birth and death is it. It's the great ultimate, but you're looking somewhere else for it all the time. And this is how significance gets endowed on sort of rather striking experiences that jump out at you. And I say the you know, some of the more dramatic of this can be induced by interfering with the breath, by interfering with the body, by manipulating the mind-body complex. But none of this makes any sense without this other act of interpretation, this act of imposing meaning. And that meaning is a pre-given meaning, usually. It's in a sort of cultic context or in the context of instruction. Or you will just do it, something happens to you spontaneously, you'll tell yourself what it means. It's what we do. But given that that is what we're doing, we should be very careful about then claiming that our interpretation is the truth with a capital T. It's actually just all that's happened is that something has happened. That's it. Full stop. Now, every scintilla of our conscious experience between birth and death is it. Yet, it's also a part of the human drama that we get lost and we find ourselves, and we get lost and we find ourselves. We're also playing hide and seek with ourselves all the time. And I think it is saying too much to say to people that, well, we get out of focus. Modern life gets very busy, very hectic. The joys and sorrows of a human life put us out of focus with the fact that this is it. And that is to say too much, even though I say it all the time, otherwise I can't indulge my addiction to talking to people about this stuff. And it's that out of focusness which isn't an out of focusness. That gives rise to the situation in which some aspects of experience, some common aspects of experience, jump out at us. It seems more obvious that that's where it is. And one of the things is the breath, which is why Patanjali points it out, and why the Hatha Yoga Pradipika gets really, really carried away. And as you're doing strenuous breathing exercises all day, every day, for a number of years, and devotes an entire chapter of the book to those practices. Legs on a snake, guys, legs on a snake. If you look back over the podcast, you'll see one called Legs on a Snake, which urges us to be a bit careful with the whole idea of method. However, you know, my addiction to talking makes me say things like, well, there are some places where it's more obvious. It's not like it's not in the other places where it's not obvious. It's just that, given the reality, given the existential reality of human life in modern times, there are some obvious places. And one of them certainly is the breath. And I actually like techniques to be minimal. If we're going to have techniques and methods, let them be minimal. Let's dispose of them as quickly as possible, because they form a labyrinth of suffering, if you want them to. I mean, that's okay, it's up to you. But from where I'm standing, that's what goes on. And it's in this vein, it's in the vein that all phenomena are pure, that practices are only for those who are afraid of the universe, that the Shiva Tantras speak about the way in which Shiva's reality is exposed with great vividness in the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath, in the gap between the out-breath and the in-breath. And these particular texts don't talk about holding the breath to try and expand that moment. They're just really talking about just leaving it, just letting it be, but noticing. They're actually saying, here is a place where you'll see it. And there are all kinds of gaps like that in human life. The dissolving of ego in moment of orgasm. The extremity of combat can expose this thing. Or something like just looking at a clear sky, or looking at the blackness of the night sky. And these kind of methods are admirably minimal. And they actually consist of a pointing out of some kind of obvious places, whilst at the same time maintaining that it, I mean, in this, in that context, Shiva's reality, Shiva's consciousness, is present in every moment of life. So, I suppose I'm saying don't get too hung up on this stuff. Explore it. Be aware that there are loads of opportunities for psyops. There are loads of opportunities for throwing yourself into the arms of stories in order to not deal with the utter insecurity, the utter turbulence, which is existence. Be aware of those things. Explore, definitely, but be aware of those things. And I'm just hoping that one day you won't have to bother with that shit. Any road. Thanks for listening, and speak to you soon.